science is where you look at the natural world and you ask yourself, why is that way? Why is the sky blue? Why do bats fly? Why can dolphins swim?
People underestimate how big an impact science has had on our lives.
Science isn't separated from culture, from politics, from health. Science has to do with all those things, and all those things have to do with science.
We're such a curious lot as a species. We want to find out what's around us.
I would have started out as a kid playing with Lego, building things, and I guess I was always curious about how things worked and how we could make things.
Science surrounds us. We live through science.
Well, I think it's all about curiosity. People are fascinated by the world, you know, and everybody's a scientist. Never forget that.
That's just a few of the voices of the scientists you're going to hear in this series, Science is Everywhere. I'm Dr. Lara Dungan. I'm a biologist, and I do think science is everywhere. When I throw a frisbee to my dog, it's just like physics in action. And in this series, I want to explore some of the questions we ask about our daily lives and world and find out the amazing science behind them. Like sound. What is sound? How does it work? How do we hear? And why do we love some sounds, like our favourite music, and hate others? If we can hear, we're surrounded by sound every day. It saturates our lives. But are there good or bad sounds? I've been out in the parks and streets asking you what you think about the sounds around you.
I like the sound of the sea. I like the sound of birds.
Well, I've just listened to a church striking the Angelus. It's a pleasant sound.
I love the sound of cats, the way they meow.
I love the sound of the barman filling a pint of Guinness.
I love the sound of brass instruments, like saxophone.
I really like sounds of running water and seaside sounds, animals, natural sounds.
I love the sound of the wind. The sound I dislike is probably scratching of nails.
Children screaming, I don't like.
Our neighbour's house alarm, which goes off every time there's a slight breeze, which is pretty much every day of the year.
I hate loud sounds. Airplanes, stuff like that. I don't like loud sounds.
I dislike is yobbles when I'm passing up here late at night, screaming and roaring. They're the sounds I hate.
Well, I hate someone that's eating. And, like, they're just making noises. I hate that. And when someone's tapping their nails on the table, that's one thing I hate.
Nasal voices and glass smashing.
So sound is quite a personal thing. I think one of my favourite sounds is that sound of feet when they crush into autumn leaves. I love the sound of just jumping into a pile of them. I think my personal hate would have to be children crying or lots of car horns. But I'm over now in Windmill Lane Recording Studios in Dublin with one of the founders, Tony Perry, whose life is sound and recording sound. So, Tony, what do you think? Is there really such a thing as a good or a bad sound?
I personally don't believe there's such a thing as a good or a bad sound. I think that sound, it's like a good word or a bad word or a good sentence or a bad sentence. It exists within a context. And a horrendous screeching sound could just be absolutely beautiful as a wonderful sonic backdrop to a piece of music, to a melody. Those beautiful textures and depth to sound are often achieved by including sounds that might not be musical. They are just textural. And including elements of those within quite a standard song can add this mystery and, I suppose, this beautiful depth to the sound.
The jarring sounds beautifully mixed there by composer Abigail Mead in the soundtrack of Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket. Now, like Tony, composer Michael Gallen agrees all sound is relative, but like all of us, he has sounds he loves and hates.
The minute that I mention any sound, I kind of think, well, in a certain context, that could be quite a beautiful sound. I mean, I love the sound of fires crackling. I love the sound of water, which I think everybody does. From a scientific point of view, I think that the calming effect of water is to do with the fact that so few other sounds can pierce through it. I think repetition is the thing that would kill me, really. Like, I mean, water dropping into a sink just does my head in. I can't stand anything repetitious. Once I know that a sound is going to come again, and particularly if there comes a point where I can actually predict when it's going to happen, it just drives me insane.
And I think most of us would agree with Michael about that dripping tap. But how do we hear sounds? And why does it have such meaning for us? I'm with Richard Roach, who's a psychologist and a neurologist, so the brain is his research subject. Richard, how do we hear?
Okay, so the eardrums work a lot like a microphone situation where you've got a sort of sensitive surface that vibrates as sound comes into it. So that will pass a signal on via sensitive, specialised types of cells to the areas in the brain that process sound, which are called the auditory cortex. And they're kind of situated round about near enough to where your ears are, only on the cortical surface, in the upper part of the temporal lobes. So these areas, kind of like the visual cortex does with visual information, they break down the sound into its separate basic elements, and then they process them separately and recombine them to form the more complex sounds and words and perceptions that we're used to dealing with. And there's an area within the auditory cortex that's specialised for understanding the meaning of words and the meaning of sounds. It's called Wernicke's area. It was named after the man who discovered it, where he worked with a patient who had suffered damage to this region and who was able to produce words, but they were meaningless jumbles of unconnected words. So he couldn't produce coherent speech. So there's a speech comprehension area within the auditory cortex that's known as Wernicke's area.
So I'm over now in Trinity College Dublin with physicist Shane Bergen in his sound lab.
We're in a windowless room in the middle of the physics building, the old physics building. That's kind of like an Aladdin's cave full of experimental kit that we use to teach young aspiring scientists.
Now, Shane, you're going to do some experiments with my ears, right? Now, I think I have pretty good hearing, and Richard Roach was just explaining to us how we hear. But first of all, what is sound itself?
So sound, simply, is a form of energy, and it moves in waves. You probably know loads of things about sound already, like pitch. You've heard of the idea of pitch, the different notes on a piano, things like that, yeah?
Yeah, probably.
Okay, so you know like a really low frequency sound is like a deep hum, like a windmill might make that very low frequency sound, all the way up to really high pitched annoying sounds. So I thought what might be fun today is for us to test what's the range of sounds that your ear, the average human ear, can...
Are you calling me average?
No, at all. Perhaps maybe you have superhuman hearing. Let's find out.
Let's have a little test and see.
So shall we start?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. What are we looking at here,
then? So here I have a function generator, and this is able to produce sounds of tons and tons of frequencies, the whole range. So like stuff that only dogs could hear and way, way below. So let's fire it up. We'll just turn it on. Okay, so, and I have it plugged into a regular speaker. You should hear a very low frequency sound. You hear that?
Yeah.
It's like a really deep hum. So that's 62 hertz. That means that the speaker to produce that sound is moving 62 times per second. Okay? So that's really fast when you think about it, but this is a really low frequency sound. So I'm going to increase the frequency. So the speaker is going to move faster and it's going to produce a higher frequency note. And we're going to see how high can you hear. Let's go for it. So volumes may go up and down. All right, do not adjust your sets. It's okay.
So I'm seeing if I can hear this right now.
Yeah, so you can definitely hear that, right?
I can hear that fine. So can you still hear it?
Yeah, I can sit here. Don't worry, I'm not that old. This is like 260 hertz. So this is roughly middle C on a piano. Okay, we can hear that one nice and clearly.
I can still hear now. I'm very happy. Okay. I can hear that.
No medical effects from loud music or nightclubs yet.
Not yet, anyway.
All right, so that's like a high C in a piano, but let's take a big jump up in frequency. So now what you can hear is, very annoyingly, you can hear 2,500 hertz.
That is not the nicest sound I've ever heard.
This is the pitch or the frequency that the human ear is most sensitive to. So this is the most annoying sound you can imagine, right? So let's move away from that.
Yeah, it really is. It definitely is.
So we go even higher, okay? So now we're up at 5,000 hertz. And if you couldn't hear this, I think we'd be going and asking for medical assistance, right? Because it's still definitely within the range of the human ear. But I'm going to take another jump up now, all right? Okay, now we're at 8,000 hertz and climbing, okay?
So we're at about 10,000 now.
10,000 hertz now, so you should still be able to hear this.
I can
annoying noise.
I can still hear. Can you hear it, Shane?
I can, but just I'm going to tell you when I can't hear it
anymore.
All right,
you tell me. So I'm
going to
tell you. You tell me.
Okay, we're at 15 now, and I can't hear it anymore. Can you hear it?
I can hear that just fine.
Isn't that mad?
Yeah.
So your ears are obviously like more
it's
youthful
really
than
annoying.
Mine. It's, yeah, okay. So like, you turn up the volume, and I can't hear it.
You can't hear that at all, no matter how high you put that volume.
No. God, I'm old. People at home, dogs in the kitchen are probably going crazy now at this point. The kids can still hear it. So now we'll bring it right up to the maximum range of human hearing. So we're at 20,000 hertz at the moment, right? So that means the speaker, it is producing a note. It's just that you and I can't hear it.
Like, that's silence to me.
Silence to us. But I'm sure there are probably young children at home that are like looking at the radio with weird faces.
That's brilliant. Yeah. So what did I get? What was mine?
You were 17,000 hertz and I was 15.
Oh,
and
it's
just that your eardrum is like a drum. So it loses its tension. So if it's not very tense anymore, it can't hear those really high frequencies.
So there you go. Your eardrum is like any drum. And as we get older, it loses tension and we hear less. But perhaps for humans, the most profound sound experience is music.
Music, it's a big part of my life. I was brought up with music. Love it. Have an inner feeling for it.
Whatever I'm feeling, I can get any song for any kind of mood or any kind of idea. So just it's a real symbiotic relationship people have with music.
Well, classical music means you can relax and listen to it.
I like music. I like listening to it. It makes you feel good. It makes you feel romantic at times.
If I'm happy, I'll play Irish, British music. If I want to chill, I'll play classical.
I find it's emotional. You can have different moods in life for different things. So it depends on the song, really, or the music.
Music is relaxation.
Music means to me actually nostalgia, bring me back to earlier times in my life.
For composer and singer Michael Gallen, music is simply life itself.
Music makes emotions easier to understand, I find, because to a certain extent it allows you to externalize yourself. There'll be little currents that you're not even aware of, and you'll listen to a song, and even if that's not the intent of the song itself, you're somehow able to channel yourself into it and hear it come back. And I think that's why people have such a strong emotional attachment to music. So for me, music is something that just accompanies life. It's impossible for me to think of life without music, because it would be like living life and not understanding myself.
But why is music so important to us? And why does it connect with our deepest emotions and provoke memories? I'm back with our brain expert, Richard Roach. Richard, music is just a sound, but do we hear it differently to, say, speech?
So when we process music, obviously the auditory cortex is involved as well, because we're taking in basic sound information. But it seems to involve a wider network in the brain, which also draws in emotional areas, places like the amygdala, which is a structure buried deep in the brain, which is very important for emotions. And there are areas in the frontal lobes as well, which only recently they've discovered seem to be very important for music and seem to be among the last ones to suffer damage in old age. So it seems as though music perception and music recognition can be actually preserved until relatively late in cases of dementia.
And music's ability to reach those who are brain damaged, like in dementia patients, has been well documented by British neurologist Oliver Sacks. Here's Sacks in a famous clip with a patient, an elderly man called Henry.
We first see Henry inert, maybe depressed, unresponsive, and almost unalive.
You want your music now?
Then he is given an iPod containing, his favourite music. And immediately he lights up. His face assumes expression, his eyes open wide. He starts to sing and to rock and to move his arms, and he's being animated by the music.
Henry, do you like music?
Yeah, I'm crazy about music. You play beautiful music, beautiful sound.
Did you like music when you were young?
Yes, I went to big dances and things.
What was your favorite music when you were young?
Cab Calloway was my number one band guy. I like the holiday.
What's your favorite Cab Calloway song?
I'll be home there for Christmas.
So in some sense, Henry is restored to himself. He has remembered who he is, and he's reacquired his identity for a while through the power of music.
For Eli Chiridaki, who comes from the Greek island of Crete, music is both personal and professional.
I would need music to kind of wake up in the morning. I would need music to relax, let's say, at nighttime before I go to bed. I would definitely need music while I drive around. So I can't even imagine my day without some kind of music, either actively engaging to it, like playing my piano or listening to my chosen songs.
Ellie is a music therapist and uses song and music to heal both body and mind.
I suppose the idea to use music in order to enhance physical and emotional and psychological well-being is not something new. We have documents today dating back in the ancient Greek times even. So let's say, for example, physicians of the day might prescribe pipe music to cure epilepsy or the Phrygian mode to treat neurosis. However, the profession of music therapy emerged during the First World War, with musicians playing music in hospital wards for wounded soldiers. And what the doctors and the nurses realized is that actually people healed faster. Blood pressure was often found to be stabilized and lowered, and somehow wounds seemed to heal faster. So the recovery rate was quicker for these people to exit the hospital.
So music is more than nice. It's a very special sound for us. But what's going on in the brain? How can music literally reawaken a dementia patient?
Yeah, I think there are probably a couple of different ways in which music is special in the brain. Certainly the emotional content of it is very important, because the amygdala that we've pointed out to be important for emotion sits right in front of the area called the hippocampus, which is buried deep in the centre of the temporal lobes and which is crucial for making new memories. So people with damage to the hippocampus can't actually form any new long-term memories. Now, because they're anatomically connected and they're very close together, it seems that emotional information has almost a sort of privileged access to memory. And that's why we'll often remember emotional events much more clearly than we will ordinary events. So if music triggers strong emotions in people, then it's likely that that will in turn enhance the memory for that song or for the events around that song. So in a way, it helps to form a context for particular memories, which makes them easier to recall in the future.
Dreams and memories are all that you left me.
So music can access our memory in a very vivid way. A song provokes, as someone said earlier, nostalgia, and connects with us in a way more powerful than speech.
Starting, I suppose, in my initial sessions with, let's say, elderly clients in nursing homes, it often happened a lot that, particularly in one-to-one sessions, actually the client would start crying after listening to a song that they just asked me to sing. So I actually didn't know what was wrong kind of with them, but I soon realized that this is actually an emotional expression for them, and they did report feeling better after doing so and after releasing this emotion, because it is very powerful memories that would come to the surface. So let's say they might ask me for a song that it was sung on their wedding day and they are missing their spouse. So it is a beautiful, I suppose, thing to witness.
A love that seemed oh so right.
So music is very, very helpful for recreating context. It can almost mentally bring you back to where you were at a particular time, how you were feeling, who was with you. So it can be a very strong contextual cue that helps you recall particular events. And in this way, it really makes memory much easier to retrieve when it's associated with a particular time or emotion or mental state.
I'll keep on praying you come back to me.
But if music helps us remember, it can also make songs stick in our head, what Richard Rauch calls earworms. Songs perhaps like Kylie Minogue's Can't Get You Out of My Head, which is probably on Michael Gallen's repetitive hate list. But Richard, why do some songs get stuck in our brains like that, whether we want them or not, and we just can't seem to get rid of them?
I think probably part of it is we're unable to inhibit that repetitive tune or sequence once we hear it. But there is a whole area of research into these earworms, as they call them, which tries to figure out exactly what sort of mechanisms are at work when this happens to you. And I think they're starting to figure out quite good ways to eradicate them once they happen. So often it involves coming up with a comparably memorable or catchy tune, but maybe one that's less annoying, which you actually can bear to listen to more than these things. But it does seem to be maybe that we're unable to inhibit or block out that repetitive sequence once we've heard it. So we're stuck with it for a little while, I think.